Hello and welcome back to History Now. On today's show, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Stuart Matheson, who's a research fellow in Queen's School of History. And we're going to be talking about some of his research that deals with the conflict between religion and science, and also his new project on religious fundamentalism in Ulster in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. You're very welcome, Stuart. Can you give us a bit of background of your PhD and what it dealt with?
I'm interested in ideas. I'm an historian of science and religion and how those have interacted across time. Mostly I look at the time after Darwin's publishing of On the Origin of Species in 1859, because that's kind of held up as being one of the most pivotal encounters between science and religion. And if you look at contemporary American creationism, evolution is really the battleground of the science and religion debate there. So that's what first got me interested in those debates. My thesis looked at a group called the Victoria Institute. They were set up in London in 1865, and they were ostensibly interested in tackling Darwinism. But the more I looked at it, the more I found out that they were really more interested in a wide range of philosophies that they defended across a wide front. And the question really wasn't who could win between science and religion. It wasn't a battle between two separate entities called science and religion. It was actually a debate about what it meant to be authentically scientific. So they had a special philosophy of science, and they thought that Darwinism, which relied on hypotheses, theories, wasn't authentically scientific. So it's really, really fascinating way to think about the relationship, not as a conflict between two ideas, but between two groups over what one idea means.
There was a sort of boom in literature on science and religion in the late 19th century. That was popular for a while, but then it kind of went out of the way. Do you deal with that or anything in your work?
Yeah. So obviously, On the Origin of Species was the big thing. Quite soon after that, there were two works by American thinkers, Andrew Dickson White and John William Draper, and they popularized this idea of the conflict thesis. They both had titles basically saying the warfare between science and religion, and they kind of accused religious groups of stifling science and being dogmatic. But when you look at it a bit more closely, it's again very much not about science and religion fighting each other, but what it meant for something to be scientific and what it meant for something to be religious. And what's really interesting is that Darwin published in 1859, The Origin of Species. About 6 months later, a book came out called Essays and Reviews, which was a collection of essays by Church of England ministers that kind of criticized claims to the historical reliability of the Bible. So there's more than just evolution at play. There's whether the Bible is an authentic historical document. And that was really something that agitated people. So that plays into these debates as well. Many religious people adapted quite well to Darwin, I think. Obviously, there were some people who took the implication that it meant that humans weren't specially created, maybe they didn't have souls, and they found that quite troubling. But by the turn of the century, most people began to, if they didn't accept Darwin's own mechanism of natural selection, they at least thought that humans had probably evolved. So there was a movement certainly by the end of the century where people generally accepted it. Then you come to the First World War, and that's when things get quite problematic. Just before the First World War, a pamphlet series had been published called The Fundamentals, and that's where we get the title Fundamentalism, Christian Fundamentalism, from. And that tried to restate, that Christian doctrine stressed like the virgin birth, that miracles happened. It tried to reassert it as a supernatural kind of idea, and this was taken up by the people who would come to be called fundamentalists. And then after the First World War, people were shocked by how violent it had been. It seemed to shake society to its foundations, and this unleashed a bit of a culture war here and in the United States. But in the United States, it was most violent.
And that leads us on quite neatly to something that you have been working on. Probably one of the most, when you talk about a battleground between ideas, it's world famous, the Scopes Monkey Trial, and that it spawned the play, and then when you go on to the very famous film with Spencer Tracy and Frederick March, Inherit the Wind. But one of the things you're working on is how that was viewed in Northern Ireland. Yeah. That's really brilliant, really exciting. Can you tell us about that?
The Scopes Monkey Trial, as it was called, in 1925, a school teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, called John Scopes, was put on trial for teaching evolution in his classroom. And this was in contravention of a recently passed law in the state of Tennessee that banned evolution. But they drummed up like a lot of really, quite a lot of media attention. So people flocked from all across America, but also from this part of the world as well. And the British London biology magazine Nature sent a correspondent to follow it, and they kind of followed it in really breathless, oh, this is terrible, you know, this could never happen in the more restrained climate on this side of the Atlantic, this is a terrible emotional American thing. But it became a really pivotal, as you mentioned, like a battleground. It attracted so much attention that they had to move proceedings out of the courtroom onto the lawn. All the leading newspapers were there. There were daily reports of the events. And ultimately, Scopes was convicted because he very clearly broke the law against teaching evolution. But in the court of public opinion, fundamentalism, the anti-evolutionists, the anti-Scopes, decisively lost. They were embarrassed by the evidence that they had to give, that they had to argue that it was right for people to interpret the Bible in their own way. And really, from then on, fundamentalism became a pejorative. You didn't say fundamentalism, that somebody was a fundamentalist in a good way. It was always an insult, really, after then. And I think because of plays and films like Inherit the Wind, then it kind of generated a stereotype of fundamentalism, which is quite backward, anti-modern, and things like that.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you about your definition of fundamentalism in relation to your other project that's going on at the minute. So can you tell us about this particular project that uses the 1911 census and the Ulster Covenant?
The project that I'm working on at the moment is called Fundamentalism as an Ulster Phenomenon, 1859 to 1939. It's been very, very generously funded by the Leverhulme Trust. And I'm working with Dr. Andrew Holmes and Professor David Livingstone. And we're questioning whether there is such a thing as fundamentalism in Ulster in that period. The main American, or one of the earliest American historians of fundamentalism, was a guy called George Marsden. And he gave a brilliant intellectual and cultural history of fundamentalism in 1980, a book called Fundamentalism in American Culture. But one of his arguments was that it was almost a uniquely American phenomenon. But if you look at the footnotes, he's attached to the note saying it appears that Ulster may be an exception. But nobody's ever followed that up. So we've got some research funding, and we're going to try to get to the bottom of whether Ulster is an exception, whether Ulster did have fundamentalism or something approaching American fundamentalism.
I suppose the question I want to ask now is, what is fundamentalism? You've said it's usually used as a pejorative term, mm-hmm. and that sort of, you know, suggests backwardness, things like that there, but it really isn't. What would you say your definition of fundamentalism is in relation to what you're doing now?
One of the things that we actually want to do is complicate the idea that you can identify somebody as a fundamentalist, because people past the Scopes trial wouldn't really define themselves as fundamentalist. I think it's problematic that we call people fundamentalists. Morrison has a sort of rule of thumb that he uses where he says that a fundamentalist is an evangelical that's angry about something. So there's this idea that, they're Protestants, fairly conservative, but militancy is what makes a fundamentalist a fundamentalist. Now, in this part of the world, we're not really short of militant Protestants. One of the things that gets people interested in fundamentalism in Ulster is Ian Paisley, obviously, and a sociologist of religion, Steve Bruce, who used to work at Queen's in the 1990s, wrote several very good books about Paisley, Paisleyism, and suggested that he was a sort of archetypal fundamentalist. The relationship between politics and religion, and really anti-Catholicism, doesn't exist elsewhere in Western Europe to anywhere near the same extent, and it's much closer to the American experience here. And also here, there are a sort of plurality of small denominations. There isn't one overarching denomination. There are large attendances of Pentecostal and charismatic churches in Northern Ireland in a way that you don't really find elsewhere in a very quite secular Western Europe. So that mirrors the American experience quite closely. And sociologists have also said that these smaller groups tend to be more militant. If you look at those denominations, you would then expect to find fundamentalists, if that's where they're to be found. Because obviously Paisley started his own church, the Free Presbyterian Church, and that's really one of the archetypal groups that you would expect to find it in.
In relation to what they actually believe, it is intellectually demanding, you know, their philosophy. So could you maybe tell us about that if you can?
Yeah, of course. Well, you really need to go back to, our project starts in 1859, and I think that's a great year to start it, because there are two huge things that happen in 1859. First is the Ulster Revival. 1859, it starts in Kells, just outside Ballymena, and this is an outpouring of evangelicalism, of personal conversions. There are meetings in barns and prayer groups and healing ceremonies, you know, that great sort of almost American style revivalism. So that's important because it introduces a degree of populism to Protestantism. It's not staid, it's not dominated by ministers who've been to theological colleges. It becomes more populist, more egalitarian, and people seem to assert the right to interpret the Bible using their own brain, using their own sense of reason. And the Bible is an authority all of its own. So people start to form their own denominations, their own groups. They refuse to become to stay members of the larger churches like the Presbyterian Church or the Methodists or the Church of Ireland. And you get groups like the Brethren, or people describing themselves as the Church of God. And these smaller, more idiosyncratic denominations really mushroom. There are only a handful of them in 1859. But by the time we get up to 1911, there are nearly 40,000 of them. So it's a huge growth over a short space of time. The other thing that happens in 1859 is, of course, Darwin and Origin of Species. And that's very important because it's taken us to be such an important battleground in the relationship between science and religion. And just after that, then, you have the introduction of biblical criticism to the UK. Darwin publishes in 1859, and then a few months later, a book comes out called Essays and Reviews, and this is a series of six essays by Church of England ministers, which introduces the idea of biblical criticism to the UK. Now, biblical criticism is something that originated in Germany, in the Tubingen School, in the work of people like Friedrich Schleiermacher, but the big name is David Strauss, who wrote a book called Das Leben Jesu, The Life of Jesus. And what he attempted to do was to evaluate the historical reliability of the stories of Jesus, to try and uncover whether the Gospels gave an historical account of Jesus. That was introduced in English by the novelist George Eliot. She translated it in the 1840s, but it wasn't really until Essays and Reviews were published that these ideas became mainstream, and they caused an absolute scandal. Two of the authors were tried for heresy, you know, so a proper heresy trial in the 1860s. And because this came out at more or less the same time as Darwin, the two are sometimes conflated. But if you look very closely at what really caused people anxiety, what really made them angry, it was this, the idea that the Bible might not be historically accurate. So there was a battle then through the rest of the 19th century where liberal Christians tried to accommodate some of these ideas into their own theology, to accommodate them, whereas conservatives were very opposed to them and just considered them heretical. So these are really like the intellectual threads that are coming together with fundamentalism.
Yeah. 1911 is a very important year for your research, yeah. And you use the 1911 census.
Yes.
Could you tell us how you use that? I know there's some problems with how you can use that, but how does that impact on your research?
Well, the really useful thing about the Irish censuses in particular is that unlike the British censuses, they ask for religious denomination. So we're able then to track these people who identify themselves as members of smaller denominations, people outside the mainstream churches. The censuses were filled out on sheets with demographic information. So you have everybody's name, their age, number of children, their occupation, their literacy, whether they had certain diseases. So you're able to pull together all of this really quite helpful demographic information and tie it to their religious denomination. These have been scanned by the National Archives of Ireland, and they applied optical character recognition to them, so they're searchable more or less at census.nationalarchive.ie, which is a very useful resource. You can input people's names, search for them that way. You can search for their religious denomination. Although unfortunately, to search by their denomination, they have like pre-selected options. So you can search for all the Catholics, all the Presbyterians, Methodists, Quakers, Jews, and then there's others, which is a very, very large category indeed. But we figured that most of the people that we would be looking for would be in this other category because they're outside the mainstream churches. The first problem that we really came across was when you search for others, the largest group within these others isn't some esoteric denomination, it's actually misspellings of the main denominations. So you've got Presbyterian spelt with two T's or Roman Catholic spelt R-O-A-M-A-N. So these actually dominate. So it's a very arduous process of going through them manually and picking them apart. So if you have viewers who are interested in searching their own local history, the history of their family, it's a fantastic resource, but you might not be able to find everything on the first look, especially if you're looking for religious denomination. So you may need to work a little bit harder to find it. The data will be there, but you may need to be creative about how you go and search for it.
Yeah. So have you any examples of the smaller denominations, what they would be called or what, you know, they identified as?
There's a growth in the groups who call themselves or are sometimes called brethren. They quite often prefer not to be called brethren. You have people describing themselves as being members of a church not built with hands, or members of the church as described in the Acts of the Apostles. So very often biblical references and attempts to link what they're doing to the original first century, the early Christian churches, and a rejection of the mainstream denominations.
And your work, it covers the nine counties of Ulster?
Yes, all nine Ulster counties. Principally because the census, there was a report produced in 1912 and it was broken down by province. So we have data for all of the nine counties to compare it with for the mainstream denominations. So it's really, really helpful to be able to compare all that aggregate data.
When you get this data, what does it, do you think it tells you in relation to these small, religious sects?
What we aimed to do was build a social profile, because we know what some of the stereotypes of fundamentalism are. There's a very influential book in the 1960s called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. It won the Pulitzer Prize by Richard Hofstadter. And it kind of played on some of the stereotypes that turned up in Inherit the Wind, this idea of a backward, rural, agrarian society really struggling to come to terms with modernity and being anti-modern, anti-intellectual. So we were looking for ways to either prove or disprove that kind of stereotype. And because we have access to that data, we're able to construct a quite comprehensive profile of who these people are. So we got just over 36,000 entries into a database. And from that, we were able to identify where they were primarily located, level of education, or at least level of literacy, the type of jobs that they were doing. So in Ulster, which was a primarily agrarian society, you had about 25% of the population living in Belfast and the area around it. So 75% were in rural areas, but 42% of our database were in Belfast. So this isn't a rural phenomenon. These aren't farmers. These are people who have moved into Belfast. It's really a metropolitan phenomenon. They're also in quite modern jobs, industrial jobs. So it was dominated by people in the skilled trades, whether they were house builders, because there was a housing boom in Belfast at the time, or working in the shipyards, or in textiles. There were a lot of clerks, people working in insurances and white collar jobs in offices like that, and lots of grocers, shopkeepers, a sort of petty bourgeoisie. So really at odds with this idea of a backwards agrarian group. They were urban and in quite modern jobs. And most importantly of all, we're able to calculate the literacy rate. Now the literacy rate in Ulster at the time was about 90%, so 1 in 10 people more or less was illiterate. That varied by denomination. In Catholics it was about 15%, in Presbyterians about 8%. But for our sample, it was less than 1%. So this is an incredible, those are Western European, contemporary Western European levels of literacy. That I would be surprised if the rate in Ulster now was much different. So this is an incredibly literate group. And I suppose a reason for that is because these people are so interested in the Bible and in interpreting it, this is really one of the things that sets them apart from other denominations, their interpretation of the Bible. They have to be able to read and articulate and express those ideas and deal with them. So that leads to a quite sophisticated intellectual culture that is at odds completely with the idea of a backward anti-intellectual, anti-modern culture.
Just a thought, because on that site where you can access the 1911 census, you can also access the 1901 census.
Yes.
Is there much difference in, or have you looked at the difference between the 1901 and the 1911?
Concentrated on 1911 because it was so close to 1912 where you have the Ulster Covenant, so that made for a much easier comparison across time.
The Ulster Covenant, how does that feature in your research?
Well, I mentioned earlier the idea of Paisley, anti-Catholicism being perhaps an important factor. And what we wanted to work out was, could we measure political engagement and particularly anti-Catholicism? So the 1912 Ulster Covenant was a declaration, a pledge to defend Ulster against Home Rule, or Rome Rule, as they pejoratively called it. So this was the idea that Ulster would stay out of any Home Rule and instead remain part of the UK. Ulster Day was in September 1912, so just under a year and a half after the census, which was in April 1911. And any man with a connection to Ulster, whether being born here or having lived here, who was over the age of 16 was eligible to sign. And some calculations have suggested that up to 75% of the eligible population signed it.
So just for clarification, your findings, does it suggest that it's above 75% or below 75%?
Oh, much, much lower, actually. The major study of signees of the Covenant was David Fitzpatrick in his book Descendancy. And he compared ministers who'd signed it, and he looked at the actual signature sheets. And he thought that he couldn't actually find any duplicated signatories. But in fact, I found instances of multiple signees, people from the same family signing, fathers and brothers, signing their names three times. In one occasion in Armagh, seemingly an entire town was all signed by the same person. So I think the rate of signing was actually quite considerably lower than 75%, but still not low enough to account for the difference between that rate and the rate for the group that we looked at. So the really interesting thing about our sample was, you would expect if they were particularly anti-Catholic in the way that Paisley was, for instance, that they would have quite a high rate of signing, but instead they appear to have been quite apolitical. So the rate of signing was about 38% for our database, so more or less half what Fitzpatrick suggested. And now there are some reasons why that might be. I may not have been able to find everybody. It was only a year and a half after, but people may have moved. But there are also, I think, political and religious reasons why people didn't sign.
Do you think it's because there were, you know, for example, they remained outside of the main churches? Is this distance, do you think that maps on to why they stayed out of politics as well?
Yeah, because I think there was a sort of denial of worldliness. There was maybe an acceptance that whatever government there was had been ordained by God, so you shouldn't really interfere in it. And many of these groups are notable even today, especially Brethren, for not voting and not being politically active. And this is really an early example of that.
When does your study finish that period?
So our study finishes in 1939. It's quite a nice way to draw it shut because it finishes at the start of the Second World War. What we've done with this particular phase of the project is very data driven. It's quantitative, so we have lots of data, we have names, we have numbers. But that doesn't always tell you what people are thinking, what they believe. So we have to do qualitative assessment. So we have to look at what people are writing, what they're saying. And we look at a few examples. There's a minister from the immediate post-Darwinian era called Todd Martin, who we investigate his writings and his views on creationism and evolution. And then we look at a figure from the 1920s who's kind of held up as a sort of proto-Paisley or the Irish fundamentalist called W.P. Nicholson. So we trace that right up into the 30s. He did lecture series in Australia and caused quite a bit of controversy there. So we look at not only the data, but what people are actually saying and thinking. And hopefully by putting the two together, you can get an idea of the social profile, but also the intellectual and cultural profile of the groups.
From, you know, the first period when you're looking at people who were writing in, and then Nicholson, was it, at the end, can you chart any sort of evolution of religious, you know, beliefs there, or dogma? Or?
Although these ideas are in some sense eternal, how people interpret them is always going to be conditioned by the social environment that they find themselves in. So early responses to Darwin or Darwinism as an idea, as you find in somebody like Todd Martin, are conditioned by what people are saying about Darwin. So it's less about what Darwin said than what people said about Darwin. So there are other figures at the time, like John Tyndall and Herbert Spencer, who are interpreters of Darwin and Darwinism. Darwinism being sort of an ideology based on evolution and scientific naturalism. So those kind of responses are very much based on responding to Tyndall and Spencer. Once you get to the 20s, there's a whole different discourse going on because you have Scopes, and to attack evolution in that way is seen as fundamentalist and, you know, old-fashioned, anti-intellectual. So there's a slightly different approach. It's more it's more about reconnecting with the old ways. It's not as stridently anti-evolution. It's about, you know, close reading of the Bible and whether the Bible is literally true, whether it's inspired, whether it's historically accurate. So there's a, you know, because you're moving across a period of 50, 60 years, the social environment is vastly, vastly different.
When this project is drawn to a close, where do the findings come in? Is it going to be published in a book?
We're working on a series of articles. So hopefully the article on the census and the covenant will be out in the not too distant future. I'm working on an article about how the Scopes trial was interpreted here, and also on an article that sort of connects it to wider debates about heresy trials across the world.
It's a really fascinating topic and project, and I wish you all the best with it. Stuart, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.